Hello and welcome to Did You Watch, a podcast by film amateurs who love film and sometimes TV. We are your hosts. My name is Caitlin Caccio.
My name is Justin.
And we are a young millennial Gen Z couple, I suppose you could say.
We're cuspers.
Cuspers. Okay, cuspers. You're on the cusp. I'm on the Z side. So this is our first episode. I just want to go ahead and do some small introductions. Tell us about tell the viewers about ourselves and a little bit of background information about us if you want to get started.
Other than my name is Justin, and this is the Did You Watch podcast. We are a subsidiary of Coffee Cup Studios, which is owned by us, which is awesome. At the moment of recording this, we are currently in quarantine because of the entire COVID-19 situation. And we got bored, so we just said, hey, let's start a business with all of this free time. We're working from home currently. Will you start this coming Monday at the time of recording this? And yeah, it's just a new venture that we always wanted to do. And now that we have the time, hopefully we can continue this even when we are out of quarantine, if we ever get out of quarantine, which I'm hoping that we do, because I can't wait to go to a bar at some point.
I know me and you have kind of been joking about what we're going to do as soon as we get out. I want to go to the club. I want to get my nails done. I want to get my hair braided. I'd like to also clarify a couple of small things on what you said. Mm-hmm. This wasn't a quarantine idea. This is not a new idea. We've been planning this for months and months and months. And we
now
haven't
is the
buckled
right time
down.
Due
yeah.
to quarantine.
Yeah, now we have the free time to buckle down and actually like record. He hit his leg. So today we are reviewing Uncut Gems. Uncut Gems is a 2019 thriller film directed by Josh and Benny Safdie, also co-written with Ronald Bronstein. The film stars Adam Sandler as Howard Ratner, a jeweler and gambling addict in Manhattan's Diamond District. Fun fact, we are both from New York City. So I'm from Brooklyn and Justin's from the Bronx.
The Bronx, baby.
That being said, I don't know if I've ever been to the Diamond District. Have you?
Mm-mm.
It's by Midtown.
I can't afford anything there, so yeah, I've never been.
It's like there are also
I can't
some
even afford a fake Rolex, so it's like, you know, why
not even
why
the
go?
Fakest of the fake. Mm-mm. Not even a Michael Kors watch.
My mom bought me a Michael Kors watch, thank you very much. For Christmas, so
yes,
there you go.
I know. Uncut Gems also features some fun guest stars and supporting actors, including Kevin Garnett, Indina Menzel, and The Weeknd. So, fun fact, the producers of this movie, Joshua and Benjamin Safdie, are a pair of filmmaking brothers.
Mm-hmm. The Safdie brothers.
Not a married gay couple, which I originally thought.
You thought that?
I thought Josh and Benny, like, I don't know, I thought
that's hilarious.
I thought they were a married gay couple.
That they
I was like, it's 2019, it's 2020 at the time
that people think I'm gay all the time. It's it happens.
So they've done a few movies together, but it doesn't seem like they have done anything chart topping until this.
I did see their movie Heaven Knows What, but I did not know that that was them. It was a movie that I saw a couple years ago about a homeless, I believe, heroin addict. And it's this really tough film to watch because, like this, it's just kind of like a character piece where you're just watching somebody spiral. And it's not fun to watch, but I liked it because of that. Call me a masochist
okay,
or something like
we're
going like
to get into it. That kind of establishes the tone mm-hmm. that this movie goes for. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about it a little bit more in depth here in a little bit.
Yeah, it seems like that's the kind of films that they make. They also have yeah. a movie called Good Time
yeah.
that stars one of the brothers. I forget yeah. which one, but I really want to see that, and it's on Netflix.
I didn't want to mention any of their movies in particular because I haven't seen them, number one. So I wouldn't want to say, oh, they're also known for Good Time. I have no idea.
That's actually the movie that Adam Sandler saw that he said, I want to work with these guys.
I like that you said that. I actually wanted to talk some time about, I wanted to take this time to big up Adam Sandler.
Like, he's so good in this movie. He's so good.
He's like an unlikely shining star yes. in this movie. We both agree that he's really slept on because of his quote, unusual brand of comedy.
Like, by unusual, they can't let the guy bad.
who did Grown Ups have you know, a nice acting title under his belt. No one wants to see that future, and no one's really looking at Adam Sandler that way. So this movie,
I think, now.
Well, we are now. Yeah, we saw the trailer for this movie, and we were like, oh, we got to see that movie.
Mm-hmm.
But for those of you who have not seen Uncut Gems, there will be spoilers ahead, so you know.
Please watch this movie. Do yourself a favor. I think even if you don't like it, because I think one of us does not like it, I think it's still worth a watch. And also, you know, support us.
Well, I was going to say proceed at your own risk. But yeah, fair definitely enough. Go watch the movie. I will give it that.
Just to see, even if you're a fan of Adam Sandler's comedies, which I personally am not, except for maybe Big Daddy and 50 First Dates, like the old Adam Sandler stuff I really like. His newer stuff now, even if you're a fan of everything that Adam Sandler's done, if you just watch this just to see the complete shift that he's taken dramatically. I mean, he's done dramatic roles before, and I like him in dramatic roles, but I think this is probably hands down his best role. And I think if you're an Adam Sandler fan at all, even if you're not, I think this will turn you onto the Adam Sandler train, which it has for me.
Well, aside from Adam Sandler, what are some general thoughts you have about it? Like, me and you have been talking back and forth about this for 2 weeks now. And I know how I feel about it. But I guess every day I figure out something new about how I feel about this movie.
Which is why it's a great idea to have this podcast.
Even up until the time of this podcast, I was just like, I don't know how I feel about it. I'm hoping to cement that by the end of our talk.
Cool. I can change your mind.
Tell me all about it. Tell me what you think.
I think just first impressions, I just need to say I love it. I love this movie. I can't stop thinking about it since I think we saw it like maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago or so.
Mm-hmm.
We saw it 2 or 3 weeks ago.
It was right at the beginning of quarantine, just before quarantine.
Yeah, just before that hit. Since the moment the movie ended, I couldn't stop thinking about it. I couldn't stop thinking about Adam Sandler. It's a very unusual movie to watch because for the most part, most movies have the 3-act structure of the hero's journey.
Mm-hmm.
There is no three-act structure. There is no character development. It's just a character study on how much of a piece of shit this guy is.
Okay.
And it almost, for some people, not me, almost has you wanting to root for the guy in a way.
I agree. I will say I interpreted this film as very fast-paced and extrasensory. Mm-hmm. Almost like a panic attack, which...
Yes.
Yeah, which is exactly how I believe you first described it as. I think it just kept raising the pace. It just raised the pace and the energy so often that you kind of don't have a chance to blink as an audience.
Right. Which makes me wish I'd seen it in a theater, because we saw it renting it on YouTube and putting it on our TV, which gave us opportunities to pause and talk, which I would love to have the theater experience, not being able to pause and just being under the spell of the movie. If by the time that the theaters are back open, if there's like a special screening of Uncut Gems, I will be the first one to buy a ticket.
Almost definitely. I think the, I consider the fast pace to be a positive testament to the filmmakers at the very least. I think it's a positive testament to their efforts. Overall, this movie, I think, was very carefully written and beautifully filmed. I think I interpret it more as a well-written allegory. I do think the story itself is more about teaching you.
Right.
Which is not what I thought at the end when I first watched it. Mm-hmm. But like I said, I just keep revisiting a whole bunch of scenes and a whole bunch of aspects of this movie, and it kind of continues to trap me.
Mm-hmm.
So let's kind of get into the plot a little bit.
Take it away.
I have tried and tried to summarize this plot down, but there's so many moving parts that I had to kind of focus on the one main storyline.
The Kevin Garnett one, right?
Yeah.
Who also is very good in here.
Mm-hmm.
He's very good.
Mm-hmm. So in 2010, miners in Ethiopia's Welo mine retrieve a rare black opal. One man is severely injured while two others enter the cave to find the gem. This is the first of these long psychedelic zoom-in shots that transition you to different points in the movie. The movie starts on one with this, and it ends on another, which we'll get to. But the first thing I notice is that it's purposely trying to space you out of time, which is really cool for a movie that moves so fast.
Right.
That it starts really, well, not really slow, but it kind of hits the ground running, I guess you could say. In 2012, we pan after this long shot to gambling addict Howard Ratner, who runs KMH, a high-end jewelry store in, like we said, Diamond District. He jokes around, he talks slick, he wears expensive clothes and jewelry despite owing a variety of debts to a number of sources. And he struggles to pay off all these debts even as he's continuing to chase the next big win. This is, I think, the time to go into why Howard is a piece of shit. And, well, I have, like, a rapid-fire list.
Okay, hit it.
He cheats on his wife and spoils the girl from his office who's his mistress. He owes $100,000 to his loan shark brother-in-law. He's hypocritical in his teachings to his son. Like, his son finds out about the affair while he's taking him. Like, it's a whole bunch of things. He tries with minimal effort to repair his marriage to his estranged wife, who is adamant about getting a divorce. There are just so many, like, he just, with every interaction he has with someone, it's teaching you more and more about who he is as a person, and it does not get better. From the start of the movie, it is very clear this guy is a piece of shit, but you follow him because he's almost like this, planet with its gravity and its subjects around it, and it all surrounds around him. He represents a huge risk to everyone around him, which comes in at the end.
He's always unlikable but never uninteresting.
Yeah,
he's always interesting, which is why you stick around all the way to the end. And even for some viewers, which I want to talk about later on, I think some viewers were kind of tricked into liking him and feeling sad at the ending, which we will get to at some point, but I just wanted to bring that up.
I was not tricked by into liking him.
I don't think either of us were. I learned
in the very beginning this guy is terrible, but I wanted to see you know, when you set someone up to be not a villain, not a hero, but almost an anti-hero, you want to believe they're going to learn a lesson, and there's going to be a lesson after the conflict. And that's how the movie's going to end on it. No lessons are learned.
Yes, everyone, no everyone in this movie, at the very least, everyone who is dealing with the jewelers themselves, Howard, his cousin, the mobsters after him, everybody that he deals with in his interactions are dealing with instant gratification. Instant gratification, blocking off any peripheral vision, not understanding the bigger picture. Everyone, including Howard, is the epitome. I think Howard himself is the epitome of just chaos, addiction, and instant gratification. But I think everyone else around him is also embodying instant gratification. Not the wife, not the kids, but people who are in the main plot point of him and his gamblings. All of them are in instant gratification.
I think all of them, you kind of see his effect on people. Everyone wants their money. Everyone is waiting for him to pay up. Everyone's waiting for him to come crashing down and be honest, and he's not that type of guy. With that being said, we kind of transition. There are several scenes that cement, or I guess build up, who Howard is, but it's not part of the main plot line. So Howard's opal arrives from Ethiopia, and in the days following its arrival, Howard experiences a number of consequences in his binge of shady deals and high-risk bets. So basically, we start the cycle. We start a never-ending cycle of the moment he gets his opal, all the things he has to go through to try to flip the opal for money, to try to make higher bets with the money he gets with it. It's just...
Well, he's trying to get the opal to be appraised, and he thinks it's going to be worth, what, $1 million at an auction, right? Because that's the thing that he believes is his ticket out. So it starts off, he buys this opal for the auction, and then he lends it to Kevin Garnett, who gives him his ring, and then he ends up pawning the ring for some money, and then he tries to pay off somebody else with that money. And it that's what spirals into this whole thing of him trying to pay off everybody.
Howard is constantly being followed and chased down for money that he is always putting into another bet. Mm-hmm. The whole point of the opal in this story is to represent the win that'll seal it all. That'll pay off all his debts, that will get him out of trouble, that'll make him more money, that will seal the deal and be the last win. But from the moment he gets it, it seems like nothing but chaos heads his way. And he seems to live in this world of chaos. He seems to thrive on it. But some particular experiences, the consequences that I was talking about, were like him getting beaten and robbed. Mm-hmm. He got Tekashi 6ix9ine at his daughter's recital. Basically, Arno and his guys come, beat him up. They want their money.
They didn't throw 6ix9ine in the trunk, though. Did they?
I think they did throw 6ix9ine in the trunk.
No, I don't think so.
He got beaten. He got beaten up and robbed and thrown in his trunk, and he escaped. And
Howard did. I don't know if 6ix9ine did. I think they kidnapped him.
I was literally just describing 6ix9ine, not Howard.
Yeah, no, I don't think that happened to 6ix9ine.
So he gets beaten and
robbed. Not that it's important.
By Arno and his thugs. Arno is his brother-in-law, his sister's brother, who works with loan sharks and essentially the mob. Howard gets abducted. They want their money back. Everyone's chasing him down. Then he has this awkward Passover dinner with Arno. And during that Passover dinner, he talks to his wife, like, maybe we can reverse it.
Arno's the cousin, right? Or brother-in-law?
Arno is the brother-in-law.
Brother-in-law, gotcha.
Yeah. Then there's the second assault to the water fountain. He just gets a whole bunch of grief from the moment this opal lands in his hands. It's immediately out of his hands and in the cycle with him. Mm-hmm. After the auction, Howard returns to KMH bloody and in tears, then sells the opal to Kevin Garnett and uses that money to place another bet on his performance in the game last night, KG's performance. As he sends Julia to place the bet, he locks his brother Arno and his loan shark thugs in the store's man trap.
Wait, Julia is his girlfriend, the one that he's cheating on his wife with.
Julia works at KMH. Julia is, I think, the front desk girl. She is also his mistress, who has her own not her own storyline, but there's a separate storyline with him
to the
and her.
End.
I promise you, I have all of this to unlock.
Okay, perfect.
This is just the main storyline. Howard and the gem.
Gotcha.
Is the main thing. And then there's so many moving parts to the story that we have to wait for it all at the end.
Mm-hmm.
So everything we're talking about now is just from the opal beginning to end. So him sending Julia to place the bet makes for a really good chase scene between Julia and the thugs. You remember, I guess not you remember. For those of you who've seen it, basically, Julia gets the suitcase of the money from Howard, and she's sent to go place the bet. It's a 6-way parlay, I believe, on that night's game for Kevin Garnett, and the thugs are chasing her to stop her, to stop the money and to stop the bet. So I like that during all of this, Howard has found a way to trap Arno and his guys in the man trap.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost like we talked about Joe Goldberg from You. It's this glass box where there's doors to enter KMH and then there's doors to exit, and they're stuck in between. So
which I think was set up beautifully the first time when Kevin Garnett's trying to enter KMH and they're stuck inside, and he has to put a screwdriver.
He puts an ice pick or something in the top of the door.
Just so he can get it to open.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So he uses that to lock them in. Essentially, the Celtics win the game, winning Howard $1.2 million. He excitedly frees the men, only for him and Arno, his brother-in-law, to immediately be shot in the face by one of them. And as they leave, as they continue, after shooting Arno and Howard, they rob the place, get out of there, and then the camera zooms in on Howard's bullet wound, revealing the uncut gem within, which I think is whatever. This is that shot that I was talking about that brought in the movie at the mine. And
it's a bookend.
Ends the movie. It's really confusing for me at first. I thought, why bother to kill him at the end? But then I kind of came to the realization that Howard would have guaranteed bet that money again.
Yes.
He represented a huge risk to all involved. Every person connected to him needed money.
No matter what, this movie, Howard's story ends with him being killed for what he's done. It's one of those things where I was watching it, and when it was toward that climactic scene, I was thinking, he can't really get away with this. I wasn't really anticipating him to die, but I was just like, if he lives through this, this is just going to be continuing going on. This is not going to stop. And
the cycle never ends.
He needs to pay for his sins, basically.
The cycle never ends. He needs to be in that chaos. Yes. $1 million is more than enough to pay off all of his debts, but the opal doesn't get appraised at that point. At this point, he's now back in debt. And of course, it makes sense to him to place it on another bet so he can win more money. The point is always not just money for Howard. I guess it's winning. I guess that's where the addiction comes from in gambling. Mm-hmm. It comes from the rush of winning and wanting to win again.
But also the chaos of taking your loaned wins, mm-hmm. betting them somewhere else to hopefully win back double or triple,
taking money to pay off Harry. It doesn't make sense.
Telling Peter to suck your dick. It's basically like that. You know, Howard embodies that form of chaos. He thrives in it. And I think the movie just kind of takes place. And I think when I said the way the movie is shot and edited, it's like an anxiety attack, because mm-hmm. I think you're watching the movie the way Howard sees things. Because mm-hmm. in the shot where they beat him up and throw him in the river, there's a wide shot where you see everybody in the scene. But the water, the sounds of the water fountain is overtaking everything else. So you are hearing exactly what Howard is hearing as he's in there, but it's not like the camera is underneath the water, so you're hearing the fountain. The camera is as far away from the water as possible, but you're hearing it like you're inside of it because Howard is in it at that moment. So I think when you are experiencing this film and its frenetic energy, you are experiencing what it's like to be Howard.
Yeah, that's one thing I also noticed, is there are a lot of big overhead shots. It's meant to show you as the audience not just Howard and focus on Howard. It's meant to show you the entire room. Right. It envelops all, it captures all of the chaos within the room that Howard walks into. And that's pretty much always the situation. So you're learning things from side characters' faces you notice in the background. You're learning things from Howard not being in the center, but being in the side. Mm-hmm. And it gives you that opportunity as a viewer, not just to follow Howard, but to follow the story and to follow the opal and to follow whoever you choose to follow within the movie, which I think is really nice, because, I mean, it gets a little boring watching one guy for too long. Mm-hmm. With that being said, the film feels really reminiscent to me of John Steinbeck's The Pearl. For those of you that haven't read it, for those of you who haven't read it, John Steinbeck wrote this book, novella, short story-ish, called The Pearl. Basically, I don't have to sum up that book, but the story warns you against the dangers of greed and ambition. That's what I got out of it. Mm-hmm. Is it's more of a warning of, here's what happens when you lose yourself in greed, in money, in chasing that high, in indulgence.
I'm a little sad because I was hoping you'd break down the story.
The Pearl?
Yeah.
I'm a little
disappointed.
It's a long...
You don't have to.
It's a long story.
I'm just sad.
It's a long, chaotic story, much like this one. I kind of wish I did break it down too. Damn.
It's all right.
So... What do you think the film creators did very well?
Everything.
In terms of plot and the writing?
Everything. Everything that basically how I said, like, I read the movie as if you are watching everything the way Howard sees the world. And because I got that so easily, I think the filmmakers really did their job. They did their due diligence in creating it. And also, they rewrote this movie like over 100 times. Because they had multiple different basketball players involved that they were originally trying to get this made, I believe maybe 15 years ago, and they always had Adam Sandler in mind, But they had, I believe, first was Amari Stoudemire, and I think Kobe Bryant was at one point attached to this project, and then he changed his mind because he wanted to direct something.
Rest in peace, Kobe.
Yes, rest in peace, Kobe Bryant. And I think at some point, his agent called the Safdie brothers and said he wants to direct, which Kobe Bryant has won an Oscar before for, I believe, a short film. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he was originally going to be in it. They rewrote it so many times that this was finally now the one. But when they originally wrote it, they sent it over to Adam Sandler's manager. And they were just like, well, who the fuck are these guys? They were straight out of film school, like directly out of film school. They only had like, mm-hmm. I think maybe two or three short films under their belt. So they were just like, who the hell are these guys? They're nobodies. We don't want to work with them. There's no money involved. And Adam Sandler was at a film festival. I believe it was the Cannes Film Festival. And he saw Good Time. And he was just like, I want to work with these guys. So I guess in a way, everybody got what they wanted. So I think they're doing their due diligence in waiting for Adam Sandler. Like, just waiting. Just, no. Like, every single time they rewrote it.
For him or with him?
They wrote it with him in mind.
But what were they waiting for with him? What were...
Him to say yes to play Howard.
Oh.
They always envisioned Adam Sandler as Howard.
And they really waited to get Adam Sandler's yes?
Well, they waited. They did a couple different movies in between then, like Heaven Knows What, Good Time, forget which else, but I think it was a good shot waiting because looking at Howard, I can't really imagine anybody else playing that role. Like even somebody who can play that role, I think somebody like Brad Pitt can play it well, but I'm happy it was Adam Sandler. Them doing their due diligence in waiting for Adam Sandler, rewriting many, 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 many times.
Always keeping it updated.
Right, because even like 15 years ago, The Weeknd wasn't thing. They probably had like a different artist in that role.
I was gonna move in with that.
Yeah. But also like the idea that the climactic scene where he's betting on the Kevin Garnett game, that was a real basketball game. So with Amari Stoudemire, they had to write his bet toward a very specific game. So then when Amari Stoudemire was out. So then when Amari Stoudemire was out, then they got Kobe. Then they were specifically writing to a specific game that Kobe was playing for Howard to bet on. And they rewrote the scene, the movie, many, many times. So I think with that attention to detail, when they were finally able to create this, I think they did an amazing job directing this.
I like that you mentioned that because there were a lot of background elements that had me believing the time period. So the movie takes place in 2012 and there's little reminders of the fact that it's 2012. Like all the characters are using iPhone 4S's, which was the most popular smartphone at the time. No brainer. Snippets of The Weeknd with the hair, like his signature hairstyle that he had in 2012.
I wonder if he filmed it before he cut it off. Because I don't know when like his specific parts were made.
He cut his hair a couple years ago.
But I think the genius that it takes place in 2012 is that even The Weeknd being in here, in this movie,
makes sense.
At a time, even they pick so much attention to detail that The Weeknd in the movie, in the reality of the film, has not blown up yet. Because in 2012,
he was just getting started
with his mixtapes. I think even in the beginning...
When did his first mixtape come out?
2011, 2012, somewhere around
there. No, I thought it was 2013.
No, 2011, 2012. But the point is that, you know, the attention to detail that they had that happen, that he's just... And I think even somewhere in the beginning, you can kind of see that Howard pawns a Weeknd chain. And then he says, oh, this kid's going to be huge. You know, you gotta give me some money for this. He's going to be huge. You know, you give me some money for this now. It'll appreciate because this kid's going to be fucking big. And then you make your money too. So it's kind of like even with The Weeknd not being a big artist at the time, just started blowing up. They're playing with that idea of time in the movie as well.
Mm-hmm. So we've talked about the time. Mm-hmm. We've talked about all the background elements, the shooting. Here's the part where I know me and you were going to go off. I have a problem with the music in this movie.
And what is that?
It is all over the place. There were a lot of points, like there were in some scenes, the music did a lot to dramatize what was going on, but in a lot of them it overdid it and it distracted me so much from what was going on. And like the music, there's nothing wrong with the music in and of itself. I think it's the way it was used completely chopped me out of the movie a couple of times, and I did not like the distraction of it.
I think that's the point.
You know what?
Well, I think just it being the point doesn't mean it's going to win everybody over. People hate this fucking movie.
Maybe it falls back into that thing of the movie is trying to occupy you.
Yes,
it's trying
exactly
to be anxious. Because and part it's of, playing part music. Part of anxiety is and, sound.
Because it's like two people are having a conversation, and then you can also hear
someone else talking in the background
conversations, like extras conversations. Mm-hmm. And then they're also playing the music, and it's all happening at the same exact volume. And I think that's purposeful mm-hmm. because it's supposed to give you like this sensory overload, like something is wrong. Something is unnerving. Mm-hmm. So I think even though you don't like it, I think the movie did its job. The music did its job in the movie, the audio mixing.
Mm-hmm. But that being said, I thought the overall tone, what was your interpretation of the tone? I thought it was very manic. It never lets you stop to breathe or cool down. It kind of felt like I was stuck in my own head for a couple of minutes. And the tone overall, it kind of just made you feel uneasy, or I felt uneasy. What about you?
You are 100% right. And again, I think that's the point. Okay. And I loved it for that reason. I have a very eclectic taste in movies. So it's like, I showed you Moonrise Kingdom, Wes Anderson Moonrise Kingdom, and then the Grand Budapest mm-hmm. Hotel. And then I'll show you a movie like Zodiac. And then we watch like The Dark Knight. And then I'll show you Taxi Driver. So I have a very eclectic taste in movies. So it's not like one specific thing draws me to movies. Mm-hmm. But something like the Safdie brothers doing this movie, they give you that frenetic tone. And I think knowing that that's what they set out to do, them doing it well and also having very good writing on top of it just worked well for me. I understand that if you go on Amazon and look at the reviews of this movie, people are fucking requesting refunds because they didn't like the movie. If you go and watch a movie, if you pay for a ticket and then you request a refund because you just didn't like the movie, fuck you. Fuck you.
That's what I said. That's not how this works.
That's not how Who this raised works. You? That is not how this works. If there was something wrong with the movie, as in like, you know, it was
like playback.
Imagine somebody thought like the editing was so choppy. I think there's something wrong with the movie.
You know that reminds me of when we went to go see Guardians of the Galaxy 2 in theaters.
For the second time. Because we loved
it
the first.
We brought my brother and we brought like some family members and we wanted to have a good time showing them this great movie that we just saw. Mm-hmm. But
the air conditioning was out.
There was no air conditioning in the theater and it was August. And we live in Texas. We live in Austin. So August was 100 degrees outside and I want to say 80 degrees in that fucking theater.
I was miserable. It was so hot in there. I thought, do I even like this movie?
We had seen the movie once before and had rave reviews about it the second time we saw it.
Mad. And we're like, hey, this movie's so good. We're going to pay for y'all tickets. Come on, family, get together. Let's hang out. And the air conditioner was not working in
the
theater.
To the point.
And I was mad at the movie for some reason.
I was like, is this movie garbage? Or like, did we just see it when we were blind?
I was so mad. And to the point that I'm not the type of person. I'm not the kind of let me talk to your manager person. I'm not that guy at all. But I was walking out with the intention.
You spent 2 hours toasting in.
Walking out of the theater with the intention of talking to somebody saying, hey, the theater experience wasn't the greatest because the AC was out. Can we get some rain check tickets if
they
possible?
They knew. The movie
when, as
ended.
Soon as we walked out, the associates were waiting
handing
in front.
Free.
Sorry for the inconvenience. I was like, I didn't even need to say anything.
They were handing out free movie tickets at the end, like redeemable at any point in the next year.
Which I don't even think we ever used them.
No, we did.
I think we did. I don't remember. We see movies a lot.
Flicks Brewhouse tickets we gave away at Moonshine that night.
Yes, we tipped a waitress in like $20 and free tickets. Look at us. We're good tippers. You want to have us at your restaurant.
So, final thing we want to get down to.
Okay.
There are a lot of moving parts to the story, which I have to commend the writers for.
Mm-hmm.
I've already previously said there are a lot of aspects that kind of felt a little unnecessary. For the audience listening, you may have already noticed that I've chosen to omit details of the plot that had nothing to do with the Opal, because there's so much going on that I had to wait until the end to break all of this down. First, characters and character development. Mm-hmm. I like every single side character in this movie. The son is funny. The wife is funny. Even Arno can be a little bit funny. Mm-hmm. All of the side characters have their own interesting traits, which are shown within their scenes.
They feel real.
They feel real. They feel like a real part of a moving family, of a moving rotation of associates. Like, even the people who worked in KMH, like the guy who was grinding the diamond in the background, he was obviously having a good time. And I think the side characters, aside from Howard, do a really good job of shining in this movie. Mm-hmm. I think that's purposeful. I think the writers did...
The directors also got, like, non-actors to play certain roles. Like, the kid, Yussi, who was in the beginning of the movie, mm-hmm. who was one of his jewelers... He's an actual jeweler in the Diamond District. He's like a celebrity. Like, he's gotten like rappers and famous like artists to mm-hmm. get their watches. I think he helped Cardi B get like a flooded Rolex, which mm-hmm. in my opinion, why would you get a nice piece of...
Damani was funny.
Yeah. Who was played by Lakeith Stanfield, right?
I think, yeah.
Damani was the dude with the dreads?
Yeah.
Yeah, he is... Lakeith Stanfield is fucking amazing in this movie.
Yeah.
Oh my God, yeah. Lakeith Stanfield, but continue with the side characters. He was a great side character.
No, this is the time to go off
about
it.
He's just annoyed at Howard throughout the entire movie, and he's constantly kind of like
fucking
him over.
Everyone's annoyed at Howard.
Because Howard fucked him over because Damani is kind of a scam
artist. Damani
is
the one who brought Kevin Garnett in the studio in the first place.
And he was trying to get Howard to sell Kevin Garnett one of his watches.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm having a tough time remember.
He was the middleman between Kevin Garnett and Howard.
No, but was Damani the one who was buying fake watches and then trying to sell them?
Mm-hmm.
Gotcha. And then Howard was using them and pawning them, mm-hmm. pretending that they were real, mm-hmm. which fucked over his relationship with
Damani.
They had
their own business relationship.
Yes, because that fucked his
relationship.
So now,
of course, as Howard's trying to track down this opal, Damani is less inclined to help him.
Correct.
Because he's not getting anything out of it. So that's an example of one of the characters kind of having their own breathing moment.
Mm-hmm.
The Weeknd was funny, too.
He had a couple lines.
He had like a handful of lines. He did a little bit of cocaine with Julia in the club one night. Mm-hmm. He was the last person I expected to see, but the person I was happiest to see when I did.
Yeah, it's always a treat whenever, like, he doesn't really do things like
this. I think it's funny because I just learned his real name the day before we watched Uncut Gems. It's Abel Tesfaye.
Yeah, so it was Abel Tesfaye, and you were like, what's his real name? And I told you, I was like, his name is Abel Tesfaye. And then when we started, I knew he was in this movie.
He started coming up in the credits.
And I was telling you, I was like, you're not going to believe who's in this movie.
I learned within 3 seconds who was in this
movie. And then like 3 seconds later, the name Abel Tesfaye comes up. And I was like, God damn it, if you just didn't ask me the question, what was Weekend's real name?
I think
the
we
day
might
before,
start
it would have came
new,
as a big surprise.
Let's start a new segment on the show. Mm. Eventually, we're going to get to it. The segment is going to be, is that? Because every single time we watch a movie and I see one surprising actor who I didn't expect, I say, is that? And you complete the sentence. Yes, that's The Weeknd. Yes, that's Kurt Russell.
That's
yes,
going to be the funniest thing because you almost have no idea who anybody is. So it's like the generic ass actor. You'd be like... Is that? Yes, babe, that's Leonardo DiCaprio. He's the star of the movie.
The last one was, is that Conan in the background of one of those How I Met Your Mother scenes?
Yes,
that we watched?
Which you had a really good eye for because he was only in it for like literally 2 seconds. I think Barney ran past him and Conan was like, what the hell? Mm-hmm. But yeah, back to Uncut Gems.
Okay, so there is one main plot line that we talked about. It's the opal. We follow the opal. That's the main plot line. The three side plot lines, aside from that, are Howard's debt and relationship to Arno, Howard's relationship with his mistress Julia, and Howard the family man. The Howard we see who's at his daughter's recital, who when he's home, which is rare, he sees his family and they're kind of just used to him not being there. They don't really value his opinion that much. His son says, hey, what's up? And that's like pretty much it. His son is... separate from that, but which did you want to talk about first?
It's not that the side plots are bad. I'm just more invested in the Opal and his relationship with Arno.
These are the moments of the movie.
Because that's the stuff that really sticks out.
They don't forward the plot. They just teach you more about Howard. Right. So that's one of the reasons I kind of left it out, is because all of the side stories, all they serve to do is teach you how Howard interacts with others.
Right.
It does nothing to further along the Opal, the money, Howard schemes. It's more so, how does Howard operate in his marriage? How does Howard operate in his relationship, his explosive relationship with Julia? And while they all have their own separate endings, it just adds thickness. It adds grit to the movie. That's all it does. It adds a little bit of grit to the story.
It adds texture.
You're not following this so you can say you learned the lesson at the end of the movie.
It's like that right moment when you're cooking a soup, and it's like that right texture of creamy.
Mm-hmm.
When you're making a creamy soup, and it starts off, it's kind of like brothy, but then when you simmer it, and like that's what it is. Yeah. That's the good simmer on the soup.
It's the cornstarch to the soup. It's a thickening agent. Yeah, I mean, him chasing the Opal is pretty much the most fun you're gonna have. But there's also, like we talked about, his dead relationship to Arne. Fun.
This movie is a miserable watch, and I loved fun? It, but this is not fun. This
it's
is
like,
not
let's
a
raise
fun
the
movie.
Stakes every 2 minutes.
Yes! Yes.
He gets beaten up and robbed, calls his wife out of the trunk of a car, out of the trunk of his own Mercedes, to say, hey, come get me, and I need clothes. That's debt with Arno. Mistress Julia, she cheats on him, it's alluded to the fact that maybe she cheats on him with the weekend when she's in that coat closet with him and they snort a little bit of cocaine. Howard blows up about it and tries to fight the weekend, gets kicked out of the club. Unnecessary to the plot, totally fun to watch.
I think it's just another thing of, well, he was reacting because, you know, because Julia Fox is the name of the actress, who is a first-time actress. This is her first time ever acting. And for a first-time actor, she's also really good. I just wanted to point that out. I think he just did what any person would do. It's just, this movie almost has some form of sense of realism in certain points, where him fighting the weekend, it's like if any guy just walks in and their significant other is presumably having sex with an R&B pop star, I think any guy would probably be upset and want to fight him.
Okay. I have no comment on that. And I'm like, with the weekend.
Which R&B pop star are you sleeping with? You were quiet a little too long there.
Mm, not the weekend.
Oh, no. Don't tell me. Because then I'm going to have to fight somebody.
Okay. I liked the story with Howard and his family. Mm-hmm. I thought it was fun and a little bit ironic to see him get ignored and to see him pretty much get stomped on. And you can tell it's just after years and years of dealing with Howard's bullshit. Like Idina Menzel, who plays Howard's wife, she does such a good job of just letting you know this is the wife of a person who has been absolute shit for at least the last couple of years. He asks her like, hey, you know, are we gonna, you know, re-talk or rethink the divorce? And she's like, nope. Sits through that Passover dinner, sits in front of their kids. Like he's talking to the kids in front of her, gets completely blanked out. It almost felt like season three, Skyler and Walt.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a little bit fun because you know who Walt is. You know what he's done.
Breaking Bad for those who don't
Breaking
know.
Bad. Yeah, of Breaking Bad. Season 3 of Walt and Skyler White from Breaking Bad.
But you know that you mentioned that. You raise an interesting point because it's almost as if when he's with everybody else, no matter who he's with,
he's not the shining star in the room.
No, not that. It's not that he's not the shining star. It's that he's the only one that's not in reality.
Yeah.
His wife is in reality. His son is in reality. Arno is in reality. Everybody he owes money to, in reality. Damani, in reality. Everybody's looking at him like, you're fucking crazy. Give us our money. Give me this divorce. grant me this, please. And like, it's because he's riding this high. Like, stop trying to act like you
don't understand what's going on.
He's riding this high because he's making all these bets and, you know, he's getting a whole bunch of money. And at some point, he has enough money to pay off everyone, but that's not enough. He's always in this. He's not dealing in reality because he's addicted to this chaos. Always in this dopamine
rush. It's not easy coming home, and it's not fun to be around your children, but it's fun to chase money. It's not fun to try to repair your marriage, but it's fun to chase bets and to make bets and to win and to risk it all. Mm-hmm. And you can tell that anytime Howard is asked to do anything outside of that, he fails.
Speaking of which, I want to bring us to the ending before we close this out, because I want to know what you thought specifically of the ending.
I'm glad you mentioned that. The ending tripped me out. I said in the beginning of this podcast that I didn't know how I felt about it. I knew how I felt about it. I was so upset. I thought, why kill him? I thought, what is the point of him dying? What did we learn? The point is absolutely nothing. The point of the movie was not to learn anything. You want to believe that there's some deeper lesson or some higher cause for a character doing something or learning something or experiencing something, but it doesn't. He won that $1.2 million and within minutes was dead. And I think that is the best thing that happened for everybody.
Yes.
So the ending pissed me off when I saw it. But I gotta say, after thinking it over the last couple of weeks, solid movie, solid ending.
Nice. What I want to say is, it's very interesting because I want to kind of almost react to how other people are reacting to the end. I've seen the reviews, I've seen like YouTube reviews, and the people in the comment section, right? People would say that they were sad when Howard died, that they were disappointed when Howard died, that the whole movie kind of didn't really have a point per se. There was no theme really. And I do think that the theme is addiction, not only addiction to gambling, but as I said before, addiction to chaos. This guy is addicted to the chaos that surrounds him whenever he makes these bets. I would agree with you because that the only way for this movie to end is his death. Because that's the best thing to happen to anybody, to everybody around him. Just mm-hmm. him dying. Maybe not Julie, because she seemed like, even though there may have been some form of infidelity between her and the Weeknd, she, in the midst of all these characters, she's probably the most innocent who is
she just lost in this Howard. World.
Yeah, she just lost Howard, and we don't see her. And a lot of people have the problem with, you don't see the aftermath.
Well, you said she just lost. I said she just loves.
Oh, loves.
She just loves gotcha. Him. Howie. Yeah. She calls him Howie. They had an explosive relationship, and it seems like she was genuinely hurt when he was hurt.
Mm-hmm. So I want to address the idea that this movie doesn't really have a point, and I would agree. There was a movie that I watched couple years ago. It's called The Rover, and it stars Robert Pattinson and I forget who else, and I'm very sorry to the other amazing actor who was in the movie. It may have been Guy Pearce, but Robert Pattinson tells this story and it just has nothing to do with anything going on in the story, and because the movie itself doesn't really have a point to it, it's just an interesting story. And I think it was Guy Pearce. I'm just going to go with Guy Pearce. Guy Pearce asks Robert Pattinson at the end, he says, why did you tell me that story? What was that about? And Robert Pattinson goes, sometimes a story doesn't have to be about anything. It just has to exist. And I think that's exactly what embodies both The Rover and this movie. And people will say Howard dying was not a happy ending, because I think you can kind of get tricked into thinking that your main character is the hero of the story. Howard is not the hero of the story. He brings destruction wherever he goes and pain wherever he goes to anybody that isn't him. So when he gets shot in the end, it's almost as if it's a happy ending. He's screaming and hollering, happy.
He died happy.
He died happy. He, in the midst of this dopamine rush, he gets shot. I think it was right underneath the eye, right? His yeah. left eye. Right underneath his left eye, he's the, so in the middle of this dopamine rush, the last thing he sees before it all goes blank is that he won $1.2 million. His death is a happy ending.
And they make a point of zooming in on his bullet wound and showing another uncut gem right underneath it.
And also what you said earlier, him dying, everybody says, man, he won that $1.2 million. He was free. I don't know why they killed him. It's like, did you even pay attention to the movie? If he got his hands on that $1.2 million,
he would have bet it again.
He would have bet it again. Nobody would have gotten their
money. The cycle would have continued. It would have rolled over.
And I also want to bring up the theme of instant gratification, because there's something very specific that not a lot of people are talking about. When he jams, did he jam the ice pick in the door to, he takes it out so it can open, right? But he puts it in to lock it. When he takes it out and they get shot in the head, they don't know what he did to lock it.
To open the door.
Which means when they shoot him in the head, they're not, it's another instant gratification thing. They're not thinking about
how. I'm going to shoot you in the head because I'm angry and I want to get it out right now.
If you pay attention to everything in the movie, because he does not have the ice pick, they can't leave the room.
I'm sure they figured out a way out.
No, because they didn't see him, what he was doing with the ice pick to either lock it or unlock it. They don't know how to get in or out. They got in, they shot him, and they even make a point that when the ice pick falls, they zoom in on the ice pick falling into the corner. So they don't know. They're getting all this money. Julie's got the money. They're stealing all his product, his jewelry. They're not going to be able to get out. So I think it's this whole thing of Howard destroying everything around him. His brother-in-law is killed because of him. And the police are going to come. The police are going to come anyway. So it's like everybody says, well, why don't you see what happens after the movie ends? It's like, well, because the movie is just going to keep on going at that point. But you can assume that they're not going to make it out of there. They can't make it out. It's bulletproof glass.
Does this connect with you in any way?
What do you mean?
Is there anything about this ending or this movie connect with you?
Define connect, sense. Like personally?
Did you learn any? Well, no, we keep saying that there's no lesson. Did you get anything out of it? What did you get?
I just got that it's a really great movie.
Really?
Yeah, I didn't really learn anything, and I don't think you really need to. I think I just took away from this movie that this is a wild ride. I understand why a lot of people don't like it. If you put this in front of a mainstream audience, people will hate this movie.
It's not a hero story.
Yeah, and it's...
Everyone likes a hero story.
Most people are... And I don't want to shit on Marvel movies. Most people are used to Marvel movies, which on the surface are very generic.
Most people are used to big budget movies, period.
And most of the time, big budget movies are very safe. This is not a safe movie to make. The Marvel movies are safe movies to make because they all follow the same color scheme. There's nothing very interesting about the filmmaking. There's nothing interesting about the writing. Everything is very much surface level. There's nothing to really dig deep into unless you see something in the corner and then that means, oh my God, that item in the corner means the Fantastic Four are in the universe. That's really what you're getting out of it. I think when you dig deep into Uncut Gems, you're finding a lot more interesting things in the filmmaking, whereas you don't really find in mainstream big budget movies, which is why I think this is not connecting with a lot of people. But the people who would consider themselves cinephiles and movie buffs, they are connecting with this movie.
Well, neither you or I would consider ourselves cinephiles or movie buffs.
I would consider myself a cinephile in training.
Wow. I think this is a perfect first episode topic. This is a perfect first episode movie. You don't need to watch it, I guess. But I think we're just having a lot of fun picking it apart, and there is so much to pick apart. We're trying to set the precedent here at DigiWatch that we are going to watch all movies, not just the most popular and not just the most well-known. We're going to try to dig deep and go... to all movies in general and just trying to make it a good experience for our viewers. And I think that's a good place to wrap it up.
Yeah. And I also wanted to clarify my Marvel movie comments. And I also wanted to segue into what we will be talking about next week. So I don't dislike the Marvel movies. The last few that we've seen, I think for the past couple years, we've gone to every single one opening night. Because they're just, they are fun movies to watch. So I do look forward to possibly talking about them. And this podcast is probably going to give me a reason to talk about the new ones that are coming out. Because after Endgame,
the
I was like...
The cinematic universe. Yeah. Universe.
I don't really know if we'll talk about the TV shows. Because I don't know what they're doing. And maybe that's something we can talk about at some point down the road. But yeah, I don't hate the Marvel movies. I think we will be talking about them at some point as well. And I also want to announce that next week on Did You Watch, we will be talking about Birds of Prey. Due to COVID-19, a lot of movie studios that just released movies right in the middle of this pandemic that we are facing decided to release movies either for rent for $20 to kind of circumvent the ticket prices of going into the movies because you can't go to the movies. And now Birds of Prey is available to rent for, I believe, $6.99 on iTunes. So we're going to get that out to you hopefully within the next week. And, you know, that will also be filled with spoilers. And, yeah, we just get to have some fun. Do you have any closing statements? Oh, wait, last thing. Would you recommend Uncut Gems? And final thoughts.
No.
You wouldn't.
It's not a movie you need to see. There are a couple of movies I think you need to see for cinematic experience, and this movie is not one of them. That being said, I don't want to set the precedent that we're going to be rating movies or even that our opinions even really matter on the movie.
No, we're just two assholes on the internet.
But... I wouldn't recommend it. I think it's great to sit down and think about, but not necessary to sit down and watch.
Interesting. I would recommend this movie. Even if you walk away disliking the movie itself, I think Adam Sandler's performance just brings it home.
Shout out to Adam Sandler again.
Oh my God. Amazing. Amazing. But yeah, that's it for us. I am Justin Encarnacion.
I'm Caitlin Cacho.
And this is the Did You Watch podcast. We'll see you next week when we talk about Birds of Prey.
Thanks.